Session number 11736, Stephen Pete, Reel 2.
Stephen Pete, Reel 2. Dunkirk, you know, did that have any effect on morale in the camp?
I don't really recall very much, but I just remember the fact that it was, there was discussions about it, the newspaper headlines were full of it, and I was going to say once again, but this is for the first time I've mentioned this. I'm aware of the fact that I'm an observer rather than a participator. I have been ever since a little boy. When I went playing trains with other little boys, I would stand and watch whilst they did all the playing. And already at this training camp, another FAU man with the lovely name of Marcus Rumpus, a Swiss family called Rumpus, he had a 16mm camera with him and I did, and we made a little film which seems to have got mislaid about this training camp. And I remember, my memory of the fact that it was Dunkirk time was that I had scenes of people who were making the bunks, extra bunks at the camp for us to sleep in, carpenters, planing away on the wood, and I deliberately put on the floor a couple of newspaper headlines about Dunkirk for the wood shavings to fall on, which said it all. And so that's how I remember it. And this business of watching and observing rather than taking part, and very likely with discussions, I would have sat mainly with them and listened rather than taking part.
Who were they, the other people in your camp? You know, were you, for instance, meeting people from other social groups?
Oh, yes. It's difficult to remember now who the members of the camp were. Yes, there were some, for instance, whoever was doing the thing that I'm talking about in the film. I think... was a schoolmaster, but he was also a very good carpenter, so maybe that's what he taught. Yes, indeed, there were people from other social groups, but the FAU, by and large, in fact, the whole conscientious objector movement, by and large, I think, was more middle class than working class. So other social groups, there wasn't a real mixture right across all social strata that I can remember.
Is it pacifism is a middle class sort of phenomenon, do you think?
Middle class, there was several things. One is it was a voluntary group, and maybe pacifism is an intellectual thing, but certainly I can't think of the reason why, but it just was that way.
How about the proportion of Quakers to non-Quakers while you were there?
Difficult to tell. I think it was about half and half, I think, but I'm not sure. There was roughly, I don't know whether there was not privilege, actual Quakers were more likely to be chosen than non-Quakers. I'm not sure about this, but I think it was about half and half.
Do you think it was a good thing that there were non-Quakers in the FAU?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Did they bring something else in?
Yeah, yes, indeed. I think it would... yes, I think it was a good thing.
Can you give any sort of quote, any factor that they might have brought in that did they, for instance, question? Were you forced to sort of rethink things? You in your role as observer, how you would have?
No, the one thing that bound us together was that we decided to become conscientious objectors. for whatever reason, and therefore that was the binding thing, the fact that some of us had come from Quaker families or Quaker school backgrounds and others from other religions or for political reasons, I don't remember it it worrying me or it being discussed, or I don't remember any, for instance, furious arguments amongst people on those things.
I knew that one or two non-Quakers have said to me that in the beginning they found it rather difficult, you know, the democratic ethos in Friends, whereby the spirit of the meeting and the consensus has to come from everyone, the sort of mood of the meeting, that some of them found that quite difficult to adjust to. You know, I suppose there was no cut and thrust, to put it very crudely.
Oh, yeah.
And I wondered if that, if you have anything to say on that aspect.
Well, not having to adjust, but being used to it, I don't recall that. But I guess some of the quieter kind of Quakers, it probably did them a lot of good to meet this kind of opposition or questioning, I should think. And there was always a lot of feeling that everybody should do everything. In other words, the senior people, the people who naturally became leaders, should also do their full quota of sweeping and washing up and all the other chores all the time. This was the things that I remember in arguments seemed to get people more heated than anything, was that a kind of hierarchy was becoming established and in particular when people went abroad and therefore in uniform, and the people in charge of the groups, because of the necessity, I suppose, of liaising with the military, had to have whoever, or the one or two people in charge of a group, were designated as officers. This caused a lot of argument and upset. It was those kind of internal feelings I remember much more than anything philosophical or religious being discussed.
Had you yourself sort of drawn the line where, you know, over which you would not step, you know, regarding service? Were there things you would not do in the FAU?
Oh, I think, was I faced at any point during the years of the war? I don't remember ever having to make that decision, but I can see the kind of thing you mean. Maybe if, whilst driving a truck in North Africa with a Red Cross on front, I'd been stopped with people who wanted to put several submachine guns on board and jump in and tell me to go off in the other direction fast. I was never faced with having to make that choice. I rather think that all I would have had to do would have just said no. It's a medical vehicle protected by the Red Cross in theory, and I won't do it. But I didn't. The choice never had to be made.
But at that early stage, you know, when you were in the camp, were you sort of facing the fact that you might be working alongside troops? And were you happy about that?
Yeah, I wasn't unhappy about it. And I realised also that, maybe I realised, I'm not sure, that we would be working parallel with RAMC. They would be paid army people under military discipline, and we would no doubt be volunteers under a discipline, but not necessarily the army discipline. But all these things, it's difficult to remember back thinking forward. In other words, I'm trying to put myself in 1940, and I found it impossible not to get it mixed up with what actually happened.
This training you received at Northfield, this would be the initial training, would
you? Oh, yes.
Yes. When you look back on it, and I know we had this problem, but how would you assess its adequacy for that stage of your service in the FAU? Do you think it was a good training you were given?
Oh, yes, I think so. And it was more than just that training. It was the beginnings of getting used to living a kind of communal life. Although it sounds rather corny, it was taking the whole war took the place of a university life, which I decided not to have, but it took the place of it anyway. So that was much more than just learning how to tuck in sheets in a bed and do a triangular bandage and how to inject and all that kind of thing. But the real training, like everything, comes on the job. So that what I remember as training and learning was like when, straight after training camp, I think, went to London. I'm not sure the sort of the order in which things. I think I was in London in a ward, one of the empty wards of the London hospital for a bit, and working in one or two East End hospitals as a ward orderly. And here where, oh, it was geriatric ward, I remember, men's geriatric ward, and doing anything that I was called upon to do by the ward sister or the matron or whatever, and with several other FAU people scattered around the hospital. I'm not sure which one this was, Bethnal Green, I think, and doing everything from emptying the bedpans to washing people. And I remember strongly the first time with somebody who died, an old man, and was told with one of the nurses, you've got to lay him out. And found that this nurse and I, neither of us had done this. So we did this together. I think the sister probably came and instructed us. This is where I felt I was beginning to understand about medical things, about death, all these things. It was a very interesting time too, with those old people. And so that became training, medical training. Those hospital occasions were more in the next year.
How did the staff in the hospital, how did they regard you?
We were accepted. They were short of staff, and we were accepted. I don't remember any objections or feelings of antagonism at all. Probably there were, but I don't remember them. Or expressed, shall we say. And it was hard work, and getting used to night duty, that was another thing. The business of two weeks on, and the awful business of 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning, learning to be awake. It was later, but it doesn't matter. It's another lot of hospital work, I think, the next year in 41, after the air raids had started. When I was on day duty in hospital, two of us, I think it was the same Marcus Rumpus, we had two film projectors. We borrowed Chaplins and other films and went around the air raid shelters where the FAU were working with Red Cross teams and gave film shows at night as a little extra thing, thereby also being able to see famous classics like Battleship Potemkin, which I borrowed from the British Film Institute and was able to see 6 or 7 times in 1 week, which was, and I don't know what the people in the air raid shelters thought about it, but it gave a bit of entertainment. But before that, one of the things, one of the things that wasn't a big thing at the FAU, they gave the staff for one ambulance train, which I worked, that was, there were several around the country, we understood, and there were three parked in a siding near Stevenage, and we were the male staff on one train, I think eight or ten of us, and there were some Red Cross nurses, and the purpose of the trains were to be able to evacuate hospitals from one part of England and take all the patients to another part. I assume we were told that. And in September 1940, I think, well, whatever the day was when there was the expected invasion of England, we went suddenly to some hospital near Chelmsford, got everybody on board out of the hospital on stretchers. It was such a sudden thing. The one thing that hadn't been organised was food and drink. I mean, we had tea and milk and chocolate ration or something, or some emergency rations. And at 6 a.m, we came to a halt near some bridge, and the hospital doctor commandeered some food from somewhere in the village. Anyway, we had a journey that went right through the day and into the near evening, right across England, and unloaded the hospital load of people in Bradford, and then got in the train and went back, and they were evacuating, I've learnt since, all the East Coast hospitals to make room for casualties if the invasion took place, which didn't, obviously. And then the train was moved to Newmarket, to a siding in Newmarket, and just sat, you know, as it were. We stood by awaiting orders. A man called Patrick Armstrong was in charge of the chief of the FAU group of 8 or 10 people. And because we were sitting there, we were on duty so many hours a day and then off, we were billeted on race horse people. And this was extraordinary because we'd been there a week or two and one lone bomber came over. I saw it coming. I was cycling along near the race course and thought it was being fired at and realised it was a German one, very low, in daylight. And realised it wasn't being fired at, it was firing at the ground. So I fell into a ditch, as I'd sort of seen people do in films and things. And quickly, and then got up and dusted myself down, and because it went away, it dropped a couple of little bombs. And that night in the place where I was billeted at this racehorse owner, they were furious that the Germans had been so dreadful as to come and try and stop the racing, and they were bombing the racecourse. They really thought this. The fact it was an RAF temporary aerodrome in the middle of the racecourse didn't seem to strike them. But they really thought that. But because we were there and because we were doing nothing except standing by, Patrick Armstrong organised us into groups going around helping, what are they called, the people who obtained places for evacuees to come from. Billeting officer. And we went around various houses and estates looking for possible places for people to be brought from London, I think, to get them away from the air raids. And it was really incredible, the ignorance of some of the people in the big houses. I remember one woman who had, I don't know, had had about 12 or 14 servants. We were asking about possible accommodation and things like, you know, your chauffeur's cottage above the garage. Would that have a room? Well, I expect so. Has it got a bathroom? I don't know. This was the thing. I know this has nothing to do with the Friends Ambulance Unit, but it was interesting sociological survey to learn about this kind of thing. we helped start a impetigo clinic, and then I went off elsewhere and to other jobs, so I think the train was there for quite some time.
Did you find people, you know, in your billeting job, your job with a billeting officer, did you ever find people trying to dodge out of having evacuees?
Oh, yeah. It's not unnatural, I think. Yes, indeed. So that's why we were trying to find out by doing a survey of what possible places there were or could be, because there were people could be lent on, couldn't they, or forced to take evacuees.
Could you actually insist on going into the houses and searching them for rooms? Was there that sort of provision?
I can't remember. I think we were just doing a survey to help, like asking questions, you see. This business of I don't know whether there's a bathroom there answers that one. I think we were just asking.
And the other thing, the ambulance trains, presumably these were fitted out specially for that.
Oh, yes, sorry. They were empty, empty carriages that had been, I think they were fish things or something in our train. They'd been all scrubbed out and washed. We were always repainting them and with racks for stretchers. So they were, in effect, hospital wards with racks both sides of the coach, all the way down, probably two high, I think. I don't think three rows of racks.
What did the patients make of that?
The patients that we took for that day,
yes, about it.
It was a hectic day of keeping them warm. Two or three who were... No, I don't think anybody was seriously ill. I guess the people they evacuated were those who wouldn't suffer badly by being sent on a long train journey. It was really keeping them warm and fed and a few bedpans and this kind of thing. They were all stretcher patients. I don't remember any sitting or walking. And they must have. I really can't remember. I remember a whole lot of them and spending all day long looking after them like in a very busy hospital ward.
Apart from the food, you know, which you've explained was rather overlooked in the rush, would you say it was managed efficiently, that move across country?
Well, I assume that if there were 50 trains, I was told, these are all rumours, we were number 22, train number 22, I assume that the whole thing was done fairly efficiently. It was a very long journey, but shunting trains across country in wartime is an enormous effort, and a lot of trains going across unexpected routes. That must have been a major operation that somebody had organised. That's all I know from our own experience. And the fact that when we got to Bradford, we were given a kind of, not state banquet, but in our filthy clothes and overalls, and because we were really covered with muck, were given a meal in a very posh hotel that started with large glasses of sherry, and then the mayor was there greeting us and having a hot meal, getting on the train, and just on... we didn't have beds on the train ourselves. Oh, yes, we did, just two for the people on duty, but just sleeping on some compartments. So there must have been some sit-down coaches there. And not waking up until about 8 o'clock the next morning, we were absolutely exhausted. But that's by the by.
Yes, I suppose that was really you were on the sort of vehicles you were trained for, really, weren't they? Or you expected
yes, we were.
To serve on
indeed,
time,
yes,
really, isn't
indeed,
it?
we were on ambulance train. Yes, while I was there on the train and doing all these other things, I wrote a letter to the Times. The only time in my life, and the only time I've had one printed, which I got a copy I found the other day, which suggested, though nothing came of it, that these trains, since they were sitting, should be turned into mobile rest centres. And it is me, I know, but it doesn't get my name. It says a casualty train orderly, writing from a casualty evacuation train somewhere in the country. So that's what they were called. suggests these trains should be used as mobile rest centres in the evacuation of London, as instead of just standing by as they are at present. Instead of herding weary homeless into large and vulnerable halls, he writes, to sleep for possibly several nights until transport can be found, put them straight into one of these trains with their salved belongings and remove them before the next night, sleeping in the train, to pre-selected evacuation areas where billets are available, though not necessarily arranged. Then the train at its destination could be used as sleeping quarters and headquarters until everyone is settled in. So there we are, a letter in the Times, nothing happened about it, but I did my best. It's strange, one of these trains with their salved belongings, not a word I would have ever used. I don't even remember using a word. It's strange. This is October 1940, exactly 50 years ago, to find yourself using a word you don't know. Anyway, where were we? Ambulance train. I then must have got sent back to London, when by now where we were living, the large contingent of FAU was in the students' hostel of London Hospital. I shared a room with an old school friend called John Pick, who a little while later left the FAU and became a coal miner. He went down the mines before the time of Bevan Boys, and decided, that he wanted to do something positive and different, and he became a coal miner, just a matter of interest. I'll be seeing him a few weeks' time, because he's still my oldest friend. Now, there were two other things, or several other things, I was doing whilst I was in the students' hostel in London. One was, I suggested I might make a film, still hankering to be a filmmaker, which I wasn't, I was an amateur, make a film about the FAU while I was there, which was agreed to. And I remember the sum of £20 for buying film stock was agreed to. That was all. I had a camera and a projector, and I did it over the next few months. This is early 41. From time to time, I got everywhere, if I remember, free by hitchhiking or going in a unit vehicle that was going to various places. I went to a training camp. I went to the hospital train, which I knew. I went to air raid shelters in London, evacuation centre at Barnet, which I'll tell you about in a minute, which I'd also worked in, and rest centres where people were looked after in East London, well, in London, mostly East London, after air raids. A couple of hospitals, one in Gloucester and one in Gosport, where the unit were working, and one or two other places, and did little sequences of what the mechanical group, the people keeping the vehicles going, and made a little silent 16mm film over the few months of that, and people who are training to go to China. That's right. I can show you the film.
That must have given you a very good sort of overview.
Oh, yes.
Of you on the home front.
Indeed, it did. It was to places I knew, places I could get to for free, and sometimes by chance, really. And one of the places I filmed in was a what was called a model shelter, air raid shelter, in the city of London, in Bread Street. And I did a sequence there because it was kind of show place to show what could be done to help people and who were the permanent residents. Every night an air raid shelter, and they had dances and games and bright posters on the walls and a first aid room in the corner. And by maybe by chance or maybe not, why I filmed it. The FAU man, who was on duty most of the time for those few weeks or those few months, was Patrick Barr, later to become quite well-known film and theatre actor. And so he is in the film, acting his only unpaid part, I'm sure, working there. And then by pure chance, again, because he had to have a night off every now and then, in May, some day in May 1941, I was on duty there myself one night when the second biggest raid of the war took place, nearly as spectacular as the December 1941 on London. This was in May 1941. Again, all around St. Paul's and all around that area, all the buildings were on fire and St. Paul's was all lit up. We went up on the roof.